Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Nice to see you all. So I want to continue the series that we've started. And we're 15 or so talks into it. And it's the series of the continua of practice, selecting a particular reference point from where we usually begin, going through the middle, and then the fruit of the practice, kind of the resolution of that particular difficulty that might have begun our practice, and trying to take it along in a continuum sort of direction so that there's get a sense of life outside of some of the desperated ways that we live. So tonight I framed the continuum of practice as from referencing to abiding, from referencing to abiding. And if there are new people in the class, or if you can remember when you were new, likely you will remember a kind of confusion where you're very actively engaged in trying to do something, but you don't have a clear idea of what to do. And so the referencing is very strong at that point. That is, you go to different teachers, you hear different techniques, you practice different practices, there are different ways that you're pointed. Each one you take on, but you don't have a sense of your own direction. You don't have a sense of your own way of moving. You're really altering your movements at the expense of whatever other people's ideas are for you. And it's quite a turbulent time, very little settledness. In fact, when we start looking within ourselves, we don't find much clarity within it. There's a lot of referencing, self-referencing, referencing other traditions, other meditations that I had that were better than this one that I'm having now, and it's just kind of a jolting container of ideas that we sit down with, and we don't really have a clear understanding of what's going on, nor what to do about what's going on, and that's where the teaching certainly comes in. Completing a beginning series, and I really understand, because I've taught so many of them in the past, the difficulty in recognizing, and perhaps this is one of the hardest insights to have early on, is the difference between actually seeing something and having a knowledge or a thought about it. We're so used of those two being the one and the same thing that we don't realize that there are two distinct processes going on. One is the actual contact that's being made experientially, and the other is the dialoguing that we have about that contact that's being made. It's something as simple as the breath. There is so much more time spent to what we reference in relationship to our breathing, or what's going on in us in addition to the breathing, or all the thoughts that are compiled within us, as opposed to just that simple instruction of steady attention upon the breath. And that's why an early practitioner will spend probably 90% of their time or more thinking about their way through the meditation, as opposed to actually steadying their attention on whatever the meditation object is. So it's under tremendous momentum to keep this referencing going. And it seems to be the basis on which our life has worked, or at least has worked up until the point when we see it's no longer working in that direction. And it gives us a reference for everything. It gives us a reference for our place in the world, our self-image, gives us a reference for all the objects that we see. And of course, the knowledge we have of objects is part of that referencing. And when we live at that level of reference, at that level of knowledge, at that level of understanding, it's a very surfacey level, a very abstract level, obviously. I've given it a name, I have imparted some understanding into what that object is, and then every time that object is mentioned, either internally or externally, that's the image that I have committed myself to in that object is what arises. And it stays at that level because we don't really push our understanding, for the most part, into a deeper abiding sense of reference for it. It stays on the abstract world. Now, the abstract world is a very fine world for communicating purposes. It allows us to sort of sum up what we've been doing and who we are and where we are and communicate that to other people. But when we're talking about spiritual development, it holds us in place. It's a steadied, fixed reference towards what life is. When you have a knowledge about something, that's a reference point. That's not in movement. That's not changing. That's just what you've claimed it to be at one point, and bring it along whenever you need that same claim in the next moment. So we begin to see that really the point of a spiritual journey is to move underneath that referencing, below the surface tension that holds us in place. Now, that's not a small thing. That surface tension is what provides us meaning, purpose, gives us clarity about who we are, sets our life in a meaningful direction, and it gives us our sense of a self-accomplishment, because we can see where we've been and where we're going, which is our referencing for how well we're doing. And so to sort of ascribe to the spiritual direction that we're going to now move below that level of abstraction, first of all, it doesn't make much sense to us. Why would we want to do that? And I get a lot of those kind of questions. And secondly, it's kind of scary to do that, because what we're moving under, you might say, is everything we've known the world to be. And so I'm not sure I want to do that. And so we take our time doing it, which is why the spiritual journey seems to take so long, is because we're reluctant to let go of our referencing. Fair enough. I mean, it needs to take time. We need to feel some degree of motivation in order to take this on. So this sense of moving below the surface. Now, when we do, it's a funny thing. I mean, most of us, the first insight that many of us have, when we move below the surface tension of our knowledge, of what we're saying about our thought, or excuse me, the thought, what the thoughts are saying about our breath, right? As opposed to actually experiencing the breath. As long as we stay in the abstract and how we're doing with the breath and all, I just felt that breath really well, and I bet you I wonder if I can tell a teacher how all that. Right? You aren't really touching the experience. But after a while, you've briefly touched it and then come back up into thought, briefly touched it, come back up into thought. After a while, suddenly there's a revelation. There's a realization. The realization is, my God, the breath isn't static like my thought is. It may not carry that particular formation of words, but basically we say, oh, things are changed. Things change. It's like a revelation. Life is a changing event. Because at the level of knowledge, it wasn't. At the level of knowledge, I'll see you later. I expect to see you exactly as I left you the next time I see you. We expect to see everything exactly as we've known it to be, you see? We don't allow it movement. So when we actually go below the surface and start experiencing life, it's all in movement. And so the first revelation, the first insight, the first crack in the armor of our self-protection, which is what knowledge offers us, and control, right? Because knowledge allows us to control the world. If I know what something is, I know its utility. I know how to use it. I know when to use it. And if I do it often enough, I'm better at using it than you are. You see, it gives me control. But the level of fluidity, the level of experience, that which lies just under the knowledge base, doesn't give me that sense of control because it's all moving. I go, whoa. Now, so now I want to come up and breathe the fresh air of my knowledge again. I had too much dosage of that. So we do that. We come back up and now, hey, how was your meditation? Great, I saw that everything was changing. Oh, you did? What was that like? Oh, I'll tell you. And then we go on from our knowledge base from there on, you see. I know that one, we say. I know everything is changing. Don't ask me to live there. I've experienced it once. That was enough. It shocked my system. Now, I'm joking with you a little bit, but not too much. it's kind of like that. So the first way we approach meditation, most of us, is that we try to master the information, you know. Okay, things changing, what's the next characteristic, you know, what's the third truth of the four noble, you know, let me get it all down here, let me master the information. Because that makes us feel like we're on top of it. It makes us feel like we've got, you know, we've got our act together as meditators. I've got the mastery of the knowledge base, the range of what the Buddha said. In fact, in Burma one time, there's a man who actually memorized all of the suttas verbatim of the Buddha. And so you could say, okay, tell me this sutta and stanza two, and he could tell you. There are people like that. And one of the Burmese that knew this guy says, well, he's the Buddha. I said, how do you know that? How do you figure that? Because he knows everything the Buddha said. I said, oh, I'm in the wrong business. I should just be studying the suttas. See, it gets that silly. It's that silly. But it's not really them that makes it that silly. It's us. Because if you look at how we weigh scholarly interpretations, you know, it really trashes Buddhism. Because it was never meant to be a staid interpretation of anything. It was meant to be alive in a contemporary sense. So that everything the Buddha said, if it doesn't have its own life in this moment, in this period of time, then it's useless. And to use some many hundred year old interpretation of what the Buddha said, well, that's fine if you lived in the 16th century. But all of this is in movement, you see. All this is in movement. I'm writing a book on the four foundations of mindfulness, and I just am not listening to the staid way that it's those foundations have been presented in the past, because I think they've missed it. I think they've got it wrong. And I think it's taken the earth and the population of people to evolve to this point so that we can see in perspective, oh, that's wrong. So we in some ways, we stand on the shoulders of our elders and move this thing forward. And so when you, to give a lot of credibility to scholarship, it's first missing the point of Buddhism. Buddhism is an alive thing. It demands us to go below the level of knowledge. It demands our questions from us. What is this? What's going on here? That shaking the shoulders revelation, the realization of what really is meaningful for us to look at, to see, to understand for ourselves. And there's something very beautiful about that, because it's not a passive religion. I remember as a child, I would go to church, not because I ever wanted to, by the way. But I was told what to believe. I believe in Jesus Christ. I don't believe in this at all. I'm just told to believe it. Why should I invest my faith in this? Why should I believe this? No one ever told me why I should believe it. They just told me to believe it. And I just couldn't. It just didn't make any sense for me just to blindly believe something. And it wasn't until I got into the Dharma that the Dharma asked more from me than that. It said, don't believe in anything. Now see it for yourself. I said, whoa, okay, now this is what I like. This is okay. This is... And it's the lion's roar. It's, you know, you can't be a passive Buddhist. You have to be engaged in it, you see. And that starts the process of transformation. That starts the actual transforming ourselves from living at the level of knowledge, at the level of referencing. That's where we all start. That has its own law and order. That has its own meaning. It has its own purpose. It has everything strategically laid out in front of us. Knowledge does that. It makes things hard. It makes things retrievable. It makes things solid, stuck in time, so you can navigate it. Right? You can understand it. You can expound upon it. It gives you a podium. Right? It just doesn't give you wisdom. Because realization, once you go under the level of that continuation of knowledge, you don't and no longer see through memory, which is huge. Let me just stop there for a second and encourage that point forward. It's when we can think we're doing this, but we keep seeing things through our memory. And our memory is knowledge of the past that coats whatever it is we're seeing, so that we only see the opinions of yesterday or the interpretations of yesterday. And so insight can't, it's like a shield from insight. Insight can't penetrate an already set opinion. Where, how is there any room to be informed when your opinion is already set from yesterday's viewing? You see? It's when we're quiet enough to move below yesterday's viewing, the image of yesterday, that's insight. Now you can touch the thing itself. You can see it for what it is. And that's realized learning. That's a very different impact upon the system than simply book knowledge. But you have to be very careful in this game, because there are many scholars, learned scholars, who have a lot to say about what the Buddha said. And because most of us come to meditation with a lot of self-doubt about our own ability to do this ancient tradition, to really engage this thing called practice meditation, we'll listen to whatever the authority has to say and give that credence as opposed to the lesser of our own experience in relationship to what they're saying. They know. They've studied it all. I mean, the Buddha said that. I can tell you, verse, you know, it's very compelling, especially when we've come from a knowledge-based community era where that's all we learned. And so you just sit back and you just... And I see it happening. I see it happening in a very formal and well and credible organizations. You know, this is a very different, we're on our own. We meet in group, but we're on our own on this one. This is self-driven, you know. This is, okay, let me see here. So when we make our decision that we want to go below the surface of knowledge, when we see that that's where there's true interconnectedness, where there's true communication, where there is pristine awareness, not filtered awareness, not memoried awareness, where you're seeing everything just through, you know, but actually pristine awareness, then you need a practice that does that for you. And you get hungry for that practice. You get hungry because we realize that for most people, a practice allows you to come deeper into the abiding sense of yourself, the abiding quality of the world. And along with this comes a very sobering understanding that I can't seek this abiding. I can't go out, I can certainly ask questions, I can inform myself through a variety of teachers and books, but eventually I have to take this on for myself. And I can't rely on you to do that for me. I have to do this by myself. And so then you sit down and you start doing it. And what you meet is the problem. And you meet the problem, and the problem is so all-pervasive that what you would like to do is to pull the plug on all of this thing, write a letter to someone and say, I'm a great meditator, and never have to sit. Then you get the reputation, but you don't have to do the work, right? But some of us, it's deeper in some of us. And so you go, oh God, this is hard. And it is. It's very hard. I don't know how many of the beginning class has the motivation to continue. You know, you look at them and you go, oh, just a few, come forward, you know, because someone's venturing forth really does have a ripple effect, gravity-waved effects. Upon the whole universe, nothing is in separation from everything else. And it does. It when one person crosses over and makes that determination, there is a spiritual wave that everyone intimates. And so we move. And so the question we begin to live with is, how am I living this teaching? Because I realize that I can't do this unless I line up my living experience with the insights I'm having. So I have an insight, everything changes, that's great, that's nice to know, that's the most commonly spoken insight. But how am I living that? Now let me give you an example. I had someone ask me a question. She said, a friend of mine is dying, you know, I'm getting older. How has the practice helped me deal with death? And I was taken back a little bit because I thought, well, isn't that obvious? But it wasn't. And so I said, okay, and this is somebody who'd been sitting, or has been sitting for many, many years. So I said, well, what do you do when you sit? And she said, well, I just watch the experiences of my life coming forth in awareness. I said, well, that's a good practice. And what have you seen? And she says, well, that there's a lot of fluidity in there. And I said, well, do you live that fluidity, or is that just something that you check in to when you do your meditation? And she said, well, I don't really live it. I don't know what you mean by living it. And she says, well, that's the reason that death has such a startling impact upon you. You haven't let it in. The living of it, the living of that fluidity, anything that's fluid is arising and passing away. And if you live the fluidity rather than come back into a fixed association to what you've just experienced, oh, I had a great meditation, I can tell you all about it. If you live that, suddenly life begins to show you its different expressions. One of those expressions is death and dying, and birth, and aging. But if we aren't going to live what we know, then we're not going to find the Buddha, or you're not going to find Christ. It's like one of those ministers who are filled with the enamored teachings of Christianity, but then has a whole secret molestation side of him or her. Or a friend of mine who is a very conservative Christian and cares nothing about the poor. That's not living the teaching. If you live the teaching, what's the teaching? The teaching is to start opening to all forms and expressions, especially in Christianity, the poor. So if we're not going to live Buddhism, you're not going to see. You're just going to stay stuck. We're going to stay stuck in that referencing, that endless referencing. And won't invite a new chapter of yourself to develop, which only develops through our willingness to put the philosophy, the insight, first the philosophy into insight, then the insight into action. That's the, see, how does this thing come into abiding? Abiding means doesn't it? That's what it means to me. It means total saturation of mind and body. If we keep it conceptual, because it scares us to live it, then it stays conceptually calcified. So the first thing that has to happen is that the philosophy has to be realized. Okay, so we have a practice in which we sit down and actually penetrate some of the knowledge we have that's so assured about ourselves, and then you begin to touch the fabric of insight, the living reality of insight. Insight isn't something you have, it's something, it's a verb. It's a living experience of life, which from the knowledge base becomes a noun. I had an insight. Tell me about your insight. All things change. Oh yeah? That's interesting. It just rattles the cage, supposedly. Okay, so but then having an insight becomes calcified unless we put it in, embody it. So this is an invitation to look and see where you're philosophizing Buddhism and not inviting it into action. Living the spirit of it, living it. You see, this is abiding gets very simple. It doesn't get complex. Like what? Okay, at first it's still referencing. Okay, I've got to abide. Now, what does that mean? So the next phase of practice for many of us is a kind of a reflective phase. It's good. It's still dialoguing, but it's good. And that is, you think, okay, so what is it that I just understood in that last meditation or a week ago? Well, I understood, you know, that things are fluid and in movement. Okay. So how would my life change? This is reflection. This is using reflection as a model. How would I change, or how could I accommodate that understanding, which is true. I just saw it. It's true. So why do I pretend that it's not, which is what my everyday life seems to do? How do I enter that? You see, how do I enter that? Well, I've got to enter it. I've got to enter it so that I start living it. Now, so what does that mean? Okay, so I start noticing. Hello? I start noticing things changing. I start noticing life and death in front of me. I start seeing it. And I start recognizing that my thoughts are just momentary expressions of whatever contingencies are arising. Certain content, certain thoughts, I start seeing that, oh God, this whole thing that's sprouting forth, and I determined it from the level of my knowledge to be me, and I was surly this morning with good reason because last night Jake called me at 2, all of that. It's just this. It's just the movement of mind and body everlasting. Oh, that's interesting, huh? Now, let me settle into that a little bit, because this gets fun, believe it or not. This will be fun. So you go, oh, well. Okay, so now how do I enter into that? See, so I want to bring that into my realized life, realized living. You see? But if we hold ourselves to the scholarly approach, that is to know that things change, I can talk about it, I can become a teacher. Problem is, you won't be realized. But that doesn't even matter in this life. In this current era, very much, it doesn't. We just will take the person who knows. We'll take that as good enough. But when you seek a person who knows, then you're seeking the knower in you. And so you're not going to move it any further down than the teacher allows him or herself to move it down in them. So watch who you seek. And watch everybody leave now. And catch you later. So the sense of reflection is very helpful, just one of the many tools. I'll use another one is contemplation. That's a deeper, richer tool. I'm giving you ways. I want to give you ways before I die, which I'm going to do, because things change. So, contemplation. Contemplation is it's what we do when we do dyads in here. It's a questioning. It's a, you know, what is going on here? It's that, where's the love in this moment? What is happening in me right now that makes me feel so, what assumptions am I imposing upon this situation? What is this reaction about? You see, it's a concern, really. You're feeling some degree of friction and conflict, and you're taking that, or you can have an invitation to come in and look at a particular question that doesn't have conflict, like what is love? You can have anything. But then what you do, once that question, which is a mental question, forms itself into words, once those words start expressing themselves into solidified meaning, you stop moving with the words and you go down into the experience of where those words are pointing. So what is this reaction? Plumb down and feel the reaction. You feel the reaction in you. You feel the anxiety of the reaction. You feel the fear. You feel the fear of the reaction. You feel the powerlessness within that fear. You feel the loss of control and confusion within that. Now you know fear in a very different way, a very different way than simply reading it through a psychological text. And this, because at the same time you're moving into it and experiencing it, you're also flushing that out. You'd be also healing it. One of the worst mistakes any of us can make is to claim we know. I hear this all the time, and it just sends me up a wall. I'll never tell you it sends me up a wall, but most of you send me up a wall when you say this. I'll say, well, what about, you know, this particular characteristic or something that sticks out when you're talking? I know all about that, someone will say. I know all about that. If you know all about it, how come it's continuing? No, I can tell you where it started from the derivation. I can tell you what, you know. It's like intellectually you got a complete grasp on this particular chain of events and why you lose yourself and where its derivation comes from and all of it. And my father was like this. You can just lay it out. But it's not that. That's not what cures it. That's not even what it is. That's your intellectual understanding of it. If we move down into the experience itself, into the abiding within that experience, which is where we're afraid to go, that's why we have an intellectual understanding of it, remembering that knowledge keeps us in the abstract, away from the truth of the experience, but the experience is dying to be known. And emotions need to be known because the intelligence of the emotion has to become mature only through awareness, not through intellectual knowledge. Those two don't even touch each other. Your understanding of where this emotion comes from doesn't touch the emotion. The experience of the emotion touches the emotion. And therefore, to open it up to the light of day and to, okay, wow, whew. And which contemplation will do for you. It'll give you an inroad into yourself. So reflection, seeing how the world is for people and what the world moves and how it moves in a crazy, why is it so insane? Let me reflect and see. Oh, we have Donald Trump running for president. That's a symptom, not the cause. See, you get quiet. So we change from a knowledge frame of reference, from a knowledge frame of reference into, then we get stuck in the emotional frame of reference, which halts our actions. Our emotional rich gives us a knowledge base from emotions. That is, I'm surly because I grew up with an abusing X, Y, or Z, and I have justifiable attitudes, and I can trace them back, and so I'm just going to sit here very comfortable in my misery. Because my misery makes complete sense to me given my history. That's emotional intellect. You're not feeling those emotions. You're using them to confirm your reference. You're referencing. And many of us don't want to go beyond that. It's a counter influence to moving further. Because we're justified in feeling that. And we can tell people why we're justified in having to feel that. And that, think. Because there are many justifications that each of us have in this room that stop us in the track of further abiding, of further understanding, of really moving into the essence of the practice, because we don't want to move any further than that. And that intellectual assurance of why we are the way we are has a tremendous hold on many of us. Meanwhile, we're fluid. Meanwhile, we're not that. Every second, are you that, whatever it is that you claim to be? No, occasionally you are. There's much more here, you see, to enter into the fluidity of it, frees us from that single association. So we move from a philosophical understanding of who we are, But then as soon as we start moving down there, suddenly we have an emotional referencing to who we are. And the emotional referencing to who we are freezes us from the wisdom component of who we are. I know why I react. I know who I am. You know, I have justifiable rage.
You do?
So when we allow that to be seen, then we have to move. This is moving down the continuum now. We move into accountability of our emotions. We start, oh, whoa, you know, that this emotion was never, it's not being caused from outside. It's being caused from holding on to the particular definition that I give it inside. And every time I give myself that definition, guess what happens? The emotion arises. Now, to be accountable to the emotion means that I release the content and the story associated with it. I start living the world rather than referencing the world. And as I start moving into action, into embodied wisdom, suddenly I have courage. It infuses intention because you see, we see, that we're moving through the landscape of our life. It's not full of walls, trap doors, and landmines, as I once believed. That everything can be moved is a movement and moving through. And this gives me a tremendous sense of intentionality, of using my life to come below the surface. Believe me, the surface, the first surface tension, you know how water bugs just stay on the surface? Well, we're water bugs just staying on the level of knowledge. We want nothing to do with that deeper sense of ourself. Too much is there. As if staying on the surface, we can pretend it's cement and not water. But the water's in movement. And although we keep saying to ourselves it's cement, a wave will prove us different, which is what the suffering of the world does to us. It proves that it's not cement, that it's water. Living the intention. Now we get so... we're really getting into the spirit of this thing. Well, I want to live this intention. I want it to... so we start looking at where we're not living the intention. Again, as soon as we rise up to the surface knowledge, we can start comparing ourselves and how well we're doing. And believe me, this is a very buoyant bobber. Comes right up to the surface. You get down and... pew, like that. And it's only our intention to continue that allows this life to be seen. Because what happens is that we drop into the transcendent through the manifested. The knowledge of the world is only surface tension. It only defines life in a very, very thin, logical way. Well, meanwhile, the vastness of existence is under our feet. And there's a sense in us that we want to, at some point, want to dive into that. And may that be so for all of us. Can we sit for a minute or two? So from referencing to abiding, which really means to let the mind do what it does, we have to challenge what the mind does to us, where we're still convinced the mind is right. And most of us know, for instance, that thoughts don't really contain much of anything, are unreliable. But how many of us live that experience? Questioning that thought. Questioning the assumption, the opinion that is formed from that thought. See, there's so many ways that we can move under the surface. Each moment there are a variety of different access points. But to stay on the surface and just know about Buddhism, know about meditation, really is of only minor importance to the quality and temperament of your life. Okay, so if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to answer them if I can.
There seems like there's a connection between believing your thoughts and having the emotions. And if you're experiencing the emotions directly, is that a way, the idea is to reveal assumptions you didn't know you had, or is it to sort of burn out the emotions by directly experiencing them?
So the question is the tandem working of emotions and thoughts, and is the point when you actually move down into experiencing the emotion to burn out the emotion or to
reveal assumptions you didn't know you
had? Reveal the assumptions. Right. A lot will happen when you actually connect with an emotion. What you don't want to happen is to reinvest the old script back into the emotion. That's the one thing I would limit. And that's going to be the first thing that comes up for you, because that's where we go when we have an emotion, is why the justification of why we're feeling what we're feeling. And the justification holds the whole history that this particular emotion has. So when you start touching an emotion, you'll touch that history. And if you're wise, you won't reinvest that history back into the emotion. Now, if you don't, the emotion will release the thought that's often tied to it, at least for that moment. And then you'll feel the emotion as an experience that's very different than the image we were placing upon it. When you start feeling the emotion as an experience, there's a lot in there, that there's a lot of history that's in there, that it wasn't the crust of the history, it wasn't just that first expression of history that, oh, I know what this is. It's a deeper level of history that we haven't wanted to face. Some of that history are the old assumptions about ourselves that are buried within that emotion or in that reactive pattern, you might say. And some of them contain kind of sort of the root issue of that has been driving our life, like I don't feel good about myself, or I'm no good, or you know, I'm less than other people, whatever it might be. That will start being seen in relationship to that particular pattern of mind. Now it's getting very rich. It's also getting very painful, which is why we stayed at the crust of just the first initial hit of the emotion and then fled, right? But if you stay with it for a while, it starts opening up its history to you. Until what? Until that history has no more to say to you. And then guess what? It gets quiet. And then it's just that. In fact, it doesn't stay together as an emotion, because an emotion requires a thought and a basis and an image in order to maintain itself. So many of the emotions that we claim to be something like anger or fear or whatever really are issues of vulnerability, of anxiety about ourselves. But if we, as we start touching that, and we see that we can sustain our connection with that vulnerability and not move it into a fear response, the whole thing starts opening up into more and more wonder and mystery. All that's necessary is courage. All that's necessary is courage. Courage is established through intention. Okay, there's a correction to that. In addition to courage, you need a steady attention. And that often requires sufficient practice so that we don't get lost in the initial historical thought about what it is that's happening to us. You see, if we don't have that, if we haven't learned what the difference between an experience and a referencing, and the referencing of that experience is, as soon as that emotion hits, we'll go off to the referencing. We'll just, it's like a springboard. That's our escape dive. You know, we can get away from it that way. We don't even know we're getting away from it. We've just done it our whole life. So we have to learn the difference. That's a very important difference to learn, the difference between experience and the thought I'm having about the experience. So that's key. That develops, though, by being on the breath or being on something in a single-minded way so that you begin to notice that two things are happening here and not just one. And what also happens is that the light begins to steady itself so they can stay on that one instead of going off to the thoughts about it. As that develops, so does our ability and intention and courage to see what's below the surface that those thoughts are stating. Does that make sense?
I find an interesting challenge to balance in our work and family, and there's very strong thoughts, and you know, obviously, as you said, a very knowledge-based, and yet those strong thoughts keep coming, and yet to still be, you know, abiding in just what's the obvious strength of silence that's there. It's just bouncing between the two, pretty much constantly.
Well, he's talking about bouncing between work and family, between, you know, the activity and reactions that are going on in the full catastrophe and display of life, and those moments of abiding and just presence and quietude that accompany those. So it's really has its, it's very similar to when we first start meditating. We touch the breath and then we're off for hours or minutes. Then we touch the breath and we're off. We touch the breath, then we touch it twice and we're off. We touch it five times and we're off. It begins, we begin to develop the capacity to hold the situation in quiet as we intend ourselves towards that. Now, when you move out from the breath into a family situation, obviously the reactive patterns are extreme. They're not just, oh, this was, that was a short breath, I hope I'm not dying. It's like, ah, everything's coming at you, right? You have all this responsibility and people are in various degrees of trauma. Okay, don't try to rush the quiet. Don't seek the quiet away from the noise. Stay in the middle of your life. And from time to time, see if there is quiet within the middle of your life. Just notice. See if there's, you can notice that there can be quiet in the middle of all this. Don't try to seek it away from your life. Let's not try to seek it as an alternative to your life. Seek it in the middle of it. Right in the middle. There, at the monastery I stayed in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa, he had an art gallery, and one of them, there was this serpent, had his mouth open, fangs. Sitting on the tongue of the serpent was a meditator. Yeah. So that's what he was saying. That's what he was saying. I don't, I mean, there are times, of course, that all of us need to, you know, find some quiet space, the sitting practice, retreating, whatever it is that's helpful. But not at the expense of our life. You see, the reason I have always taught and continue to want to teach daily life is because unless we can find it here, as difficult as it is, and believe me, the distractions are numerous, and the reactive patterns are, unless we can find it there, then we will find it as an alternative to being here. And then we will have lost the game. Because there is no alternative to truth. And so I don't try to find it as a competition. I wish this weren't happening so I could be here. Because then I'm just creating the suffering of my misery about not being quiet or having a family that's quiet. So it can't be that way. That doesn't work. So if it's not that way, what way is it? Follow me here. It's that way. Do you understand what I... See, we just proved it. Now bring it on.
It seemed like when you did that, the words that came to me were like surrender and then love. Is it something like that?
When I just did that, it seemed to her that it was like surrender and love. Okay? You surrender into love. That's one way of framing this. Right? When you're fighting it, there's no love, because struggle is just a tension of the heart, right? So that there's nothing can get out of there except wishing that you weren't there. When you're surrendering your being there. And then there's love,
yeah, no
right?
Escape.
No escape. Right? Right. Okay, all. Thank you. Thank you. Next week, discussion on this topic and some encouragement to embody the teaching. It will be my last time with you until June. So I'm getting pretty... demanding here, I guess, would be the right word. All right.